And the girl said, well, I got to give you credit. I've never seen a blind person do it that way before. But most people just squeeze the toothpaste on their tongue. I said, well, I'll use that one next time. The sad thing about being blind about it is the part that I didn't get to see is, and I get emotional thinking about it, but later they told me that all the racers stopped what they were doing and just went out towards the salt and watched me. You know, they wanted to see that piece of history, you know, and what I was doing. So if I could go over 200, I'll become the world's fastest blind man. Everybody that graduates, they're an absolutely changed person the day they leave than they were the day they started. It changes your life. Take it one day at a time. Don't let it overwhelm you. And to always know there is a life after blindness.
Welcome to Blind Abilities. I'm Jeff Thompson. And with me from Jacksonville, Florida, we got Pete Lane. How are you doing, Pete?
Great, Jeff. How are you doing this morning?
Well, it's a scorcher up here. Is it still hot down there in Jacksonville, Pete?
About 101 yesterday in the shade.
Oof, that's pretty hot, Pete. That's pretty hot. Well, we got a guest today on the Blind Abilities podcast. This is Dan Parker. He's from about 100 miles south of Atlanta, Georgia. He's a former 2005 Pro Nitrous World Champion race car driver.
Hello, guys.
How are you doing, Dan?
I'm doing great, along with suffering from this heat myself.
Yeah, South Georgia.
I think it got about 95 degrees yesterday and probably about 90% humidity.
That's the killer.
Yes.
Minnesota, we've been having like 90% humidity and some heat too, so I can, for a few days I'll know what it's like to be you guys.
Yeah.
Hot stuff. That's scorching. Just like you used to scorch down the track in those Pro Nitrous race cars. Tell our listeners a little bit about your history there, Dan.
My entire life, I've raced cars. The first time I went down the drag strip, I was 8 years old on a mini bike. When I was about 20, I started racing, every weekend. When I gradually progressed to faster and faster cars, in roughly 1997, I raced my first Pro Modified car for Ellis Miller. And a Pro Mod is the fastest door slammers, the car with a door on the left that swings to get open. And so you can run a turbocharged, a blower, or a nitrous injected combination. And I've always raced nitrous cars and a few turbo cars along the way. And so I started racing in 97. 2005, I won the ADRL Pro Nitrous World Championship driving for Bill George out of Atlanta, Georgia. And March 31st, 2012 was a regular day, just like we've done 1,000 times before, testing a brand new motor combination, fourth pass of the day, the first full pass, right at the 8th mile mark, car made a hard right turn, hit a poured concrete wall, cut the car in half. I woke 2 weeks later from induced coma for them to realize my brain swollen and compressed my optic nerve. And I was completely blind. So, I had numerous physical injuries. And so at the very beginning, I was depressed and had to figure out, had to have a goal, had to have a purpose, had to get back to racing, interact with the people that I knew the racing world. I set out to build a motorcycle to become the first blind man to ever race the Bonneville Salt Flats, which is 120 miles west of Salt Lake City, where people have been setting land speed records since 1914, and I went in 2013, became the first blind man to ever race assault. I returned in 2014 to set my class record for the 50 to 85cc two-stroke single-cylinder cycle car, which a three-wheel motorcycle is considered a cycle car. So I set that class record at a two-way average speed of 62.05 miles per hour, totally 100% independently.
So you're motorcycle that you built is 70 cc's?
Yes. It was a 50, and I put an Athena big bore kit in it.
Top end is 75, 80?
It'll probably run 80. The fastest I went at the salt was 64.8. The carburetor was running real rich because the salt, I think the corrected altitude is about 4,500 feet. Mm-hmm. And the weather, the last year I went, when I set my FIM record, the weather was really bad, so we missed 2 days because of rain. And my ultimate goal was, once I set my class record,
I was going to go back, change some gear ratio sprockets, and I was actually going to put a little nitromethane in the gas to try to bump it up a little bit and, you know, try to increase the record some more. But I didn't set my class record to the last day with only about 2 hours left. So once I did that, I was
you were done.
Yeah.
So 64.8 is the class record still?
Yeah, it's actually the average, because what they do, you have to, in my class, you start off at mile 2 and you accelerate to mile 3, and then they measure your speed, an average between mile marker 3 and 4. If that breaks, you know, that sets a class record, then you have to go to inspection. They inspect your everything. Then you have to go the opposite end of the track and return the opposite direction. So if the wind is giving you assistance one way, it'll hurt you the other. So it averages out. So okay. My average speed was 62.05 miles per hour.
Sweet.
For my record.
So Dan, tell me what it was like to ride your bike into the NFB convention hall.
that was a good time. Dr. Maurer asked me to do that. And I think me and Dr. Maurer have a lot in common. He likes to do, I think, something a little different every now and then. That's definitely how I am. So he asked me, can we do that? I said, yeah, we can make it happen. So
I could hear him now. Dan, would you like to ride your motorcycle into the hall?
Yes. And of course I say, heck yeah. You know, and like I used to tell folks, I do all my own stunts. Just that last one's the one that got me blind. But so he asked me if we could do it, and I said, yeah, we'll make it happen.
First item on this morning's agenda is being presented by Dan Parker. It is entitled The Blind at Speed. A race driver from Salem, Alabama, Dan Parker.
Good morning, Federation. So I hope a little smell of racing gas is okay first thing in the morning.
So most people don't realize that I never got to practice until that morning, because we had to pull a special fire permit from the city to allow a motorcycle running inside that building. So the fire marshal came at 7 o'clock. Me and the guys were there ready, practiced a couple times, and we had the permit, I think, until 11. But as soon as I got finished practicing, then I had to run up to my room and take a shower, you know, come back down, sort of stay out of the way. They had me in a little curtain to the right. And, you know, so I got off the motorcycle, gave a speech, which, you know, for a blind person that doesn't read Braille, everything's from the hip because it's a little hard to see the teleprompter. And so,
yeah, that was a good speech. I heard it.
That was a good day. That was a really good day.
How long was it till you went to Louisiana Center for the Blind?
I started LCB, I think, in May of 2014.
How'd that go for you, those 2 years?
For the most part, it went pretty good. You know, when I came home, blindness was only one of my issues. I had broke ribs, collapsed lung, crushed vertebrae in my back, a chipped one in my neck, a broke tailbone, which is absolutely a pain in the butt, and my whole right arm was almost destroyed. I have pins in between my shoulder and my elbow. I have plates and 14 screws still in that elbow, another pin in the forearm, a pin in my thumb. So all the nerves in my right hand are jacked up. If I squeeze my thumb, my index finger feels like it's stinging and expanding. So blindness was only one of my issues. So I had to get through so many of my physical issues before I was ready to try to go to LCB or something like that. You know, I'm still not 100%. I'll never be 100%, but, you know, I'm far better than I ever was before.
And this all started because you were in the top fuel drag racing.
I was in what's called, the class is called Pro Modified. And what that is, that's the fastest cars that has a door that swings open to the left. You know, funny cars, the body flips up, and dragsters are those long rails. And so my door slammers is what they call them. And my class is the fastest class there is. The motor, the day I wrecked, that motor was brand new. You know, I drove for somebody else. I never could afford this, but that motor is brand new. It cost $90,000.
Whoa.
It was 864 cubic inches plus four stages of nitrous oxide. It would make about 2,500 horsepower with the nitrous on.
Mm. Oof. And then you had your accident.
Yeah. Yep. First day out with that new motor, we were testing, and then first full pass. We don't know exactly what happened. We decided to try to qualify for the race. The testing was going so good that, I mean, we were just ecstatic. The pass before, I had the far best 60-foot I've ever had in my career. Car was doing good, so we decided to enter the race. First round qualifying. We don't know. I sort of, you know, think that maybe the car in front of me puked a little oil out of it, you know, and nobody you can't wreck, you know, the guy that did it, if that's what happened, he wouldn't have known, because he's, you know, he's shutting the car down and he's on the return road picking up parachutes and all that, and they're already sending me down the track, so he wouldn't have known, nor would he have had time to communicate to the tower. So if nobody noticed it, it's just part of it. And so that's what I suspect. But right at the 8th mile mark, at 175 miles per hour, the car just took a hard right turn straight into a poured concrete wall. Mm. And it just flipped over. The car was already airborne. If you imagine a car making a hard right turn and then sort of flipping up over on its side, all four tires were off the ground when it was going across the track. So when it hit, it flipped over the wall, made several tumbles, and the car was cut in half. There was no engine, no transmission, no firewall, no steering column. My feet were hanging out in the air, you know, and then it come to a stop on its roof. Then weather came in, you know, just one of them, if I could have, should have, would have, they don't count in life, but if I'd been in the back of the lines, it wouldn't have happened, because it rained about 20 minutes after my wreck, and it started raining so bad that the lifeline helicopter could not land. So they had to put me in an ambulance and rush me to the University of Alabama, UAB, which is about a 45-minute ride. My girlfriend, mm-hmm. Jennifer, got shotgun in the ambulance, and they really didn't know if I was going to make it. They called ahead and got another ambulance to meet them on the side of the highway so those EMTs could get my ambulance and help work on me to keep me going until I got to UAB.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it was bad. I'm not supposed to be here.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So they induced a coma, and 2 weeks later, yeah, they found out your optic nerve was compressed.
Yeah, I was putting an induced coma, and then, you know, I had all kinds of crazy dreams and everything. But when they brought me out of the coma, I was still so doped up on drugs and pain pills and, you know, everything else, morphine, that I didn't even recognize that I could not see. For about a day, you know, people, family and friends were coming to see me in the hospital, and I was talking to them. And if they made a noise, I would look straight at them, but my pupils didn't look right. And then Jennifer, my sister, you know, next day they called the doctor and said something's not right, because what they noticed is one person went on one side of the hospital bed, and I didn't even recognize the person on the other side until they spoke. Then I looked at him, you know, and I guess it sort of startled me, you know, and then they called the doctor, you know, they had to come check me out.
Do you remember that? And what did you see, or what did you think you saw?
I don't remember that. I don't remember it. And so, like I said, you know, with my brain injury and just, you know, also suffered a TBI, traumatic brain injury. So with everything else going on, that first week was really a blur for the most part.
So when you were coming out of all this and healing and stuff and realizing you're blind, what was the process? Did they say you got to contact your state services?
They didn't really tell me much of nothing.
And that's typical.
Yeah. All right. I was brought out of the coma and I was put into a step down room for a week. Well, then I was transferred on the next Monday to a rehab center, Spain Rehab Center. And doctor came in there just talking in general. And I was already, you know, mad and agitated this time. And I said, when am I going home? He said, well, you're going to be here about 3 weeks. I said, why? He said, well, there's a certain amount of, you know, criteria that you have to meet before we can release you. And I said, I'm going home Friday. And so I told him, I said, I have ruined my life. I'll go home and I'll bounce off the walls and I'll figure it out. That's the exact words I told the doctor. Well, I said, what do I have to meet criteria-wise? He said, you have to be able to brush your teeth. You have to be able to dress yourself, some basic navigation skills. I said, okay, when do we start? He said, nurse will be here tomorrow morning. I told him, I said, tell her she better be ready. So the first morning, first obstacle was brush my teeth. So I put my right arm is completely useless at this time, stuck straight, cast, totally, I'm doing this one arm and not my normal arm. I'm right-handed, had to do everything my left hand. So I stick the toothbrush in my mouth, open the toothpaste, squeeze the toothpaste on the brush, set it down, brush my teeth. And the girl said, well, I got to give you credit. I've never seen a blind person do it that way before. But most people just squeeze the toothpaste on their tongue. I said, well, I'll use that one next time. So next step, dress myself. I did. And then the next day, they got me a broom handle. Exactly what they got, and I walked around the halls a little bit and, just basic, crude, mobility. And so the doctor came in on Thursday, said, I'm not going to block you. You can go home. So I went home on that Friday morning. So we went home and then, did a little research and the lady came on Thursday. There's an O&M instructor from that area, and she gave me a cane. A folding cane with a ball on it, roller ball. And so I contacted her after we got home, a couple weeks after we got home. Then she sort of set the things in motion to get me in touch with, VR counselors and everything else,
What'd you think of the roller ball?
Well, at first, I liked it. I didn't know any different, but now I realize that, it doesn't give me the feedback, and now I use a long white cane, typical NFB style cane. But it was good, it was definitely convenient because you fold it up, There's no issue,
So how'd you get in contact with Louisiana Center for the Blind?
When I first started doing my motorcycle, probably about 3 or 4 months into the deal, I just called NFB up one day, I'd watched the video on the Blind Driver Challenge, learned about it. So I just wanted to talk to somebody just to sort of find out a little information. I called NFB and they put me on the phone with Joanne Wilson. And she's actually who started Louisiana Center for the Blind, but she's working at Baltimore at the time. Mm-hmm. And told her sort of what I was doing. And, she was very interested. Well, about a month later, she called me, asked me progress. And I told her. About a month later, she called me. Well, so about, I guess, March of the next year, maybe May, she told Mark Riccobono, she said, you need to talk to this guy. He's going to do it, And Mark, at first, he was real skeptical. He's like, this guy, he's never been in training or anything else, And he wasn't being a negative. He's just being, how somebody that's never been any skills going to do this as far as blindness-wise. Well, so I flew to Baltimore, and they ended up helped me, my first year, and Mark actually went to the SALT with me my first year in 2013 when I became the official first blind man to race at the SALT Flats. Riccobono was there.
Wow.
And so, so then learning, this is before he was president. So then, after being, going back and forth to Baltimore a few times and being around Mark and seeing how well he navigates and, all the skills he has, and I knew at one point, this is what I was going to have to do to, better myself, to push myself. I was going to have to go somewhere for some training.
So you went to Bonneville before you went to LCB?
Yes, the first year. All right, 2013, I went to Bonneville, became the first blind man to first blind man to ever race the SALT.
Right.
Then as soon as I got home, I wasn't happy. I all I did was got to make one pass. There was a lot of government bureaucracy. Some stuff happened at SALT. I told myself, I'm going to go home and regroup. Well, I came home and regrouped and then returned in 2014 with the one purpose goal is to set a true international land speed record that has absolutely nothing special asterisks beside it for blindness. I raced in a class against other people and I set my class record.
Now, you used a device that would tell you if you're off center.
Yes. A friend of mine, Patrick Johnson, he's an engineer at Boeing. When I first dreamed it, before I even had a motorcycle, I called Patrick, told him what my idea was. He said, I can build you a guidance system. Don't even sweat that. And I said, okay, you're in. He said, I'm in. He said, you know, if that's your worries, you got nothing to worry about. So
we all need an engineer for a friend.
yeah, no doubt. And so Patrick made the guidance system. It's GPS based. Well, the first week, and granted, this is only 3 weeks before I had to be at the salt flats, we went up North Alabama, installed the guidance system. We went to a local small, airport that he has some friends, and they said, all right, we'll let y'all practice on the runway. You know, if a plane stands land, y'all got to get in the grass. Well, the first system was giving me too much information too slow. So after I realized that, you know, this is them pushing me around, I never cranked up the motor's time, just trying to understand a little bit what to do. So Patrick, we left that week. Patrick went home, reprogrammed the whole deal. We met back the following week. He tweaked a few things, and I practiced with them pushing me around with a foiler. And then I said, all right, I think I'm ready. And so the first time I tried it, I made it all the way down the runway by myself.
This is 2 weeks out from Bonneville.
This is 2 weeks before I have to be at Bonneville. And so we filmed it, and we sent it to the officials, said he did it. You know, because at this point, I didn't care if I ran 35 miles an hour at salt. I just wanted to race, you know. And I probably ran 25 or 30 that weekend at the airport. But I did it, and I knew I could do it then, you know. And so I came home. We still had to pack a trailer and just crazy amount of organization stuff to make it happen. And, you know, I had a bunch of buddies volunteer to drive me out there. Because it takes 3 or 4 days to get there. It's 2,400 miles from my house.
And we're in Utah, right?
Yeah, 130 miles west of Salt Lake City.
Right.
So we went out there, and then the first day we had to demonstrate that it worked. They took us way away from the race course. We set up a little temporary course, and they observed me. I practiced. They observed me. End of the day, the officials came back and observed me. And before they give me the go-ahead, they said, we want to put another rider on your motorcycle and test it. I said, okay, I don't care. I'm not here to hide anything. So an independent rider from Germany got on my bike, put on my helmet, all my guidance system equipment, and he made it go to the left out of bounds. Motorcycle shut off. So next pass, he made all the way down the course. When it went through the finish line, motorcycle shut off. He told me, he said, it works. It does exactly what he promised it would do. So the next day I was able to make my first pass on salt. And what was really the sad thing about being blind about it is the part that I didn't get to see is, and I get emotional thinking about it, but later they told me that all the racers stopped what they were doing and just went out towards the salt and watched me. You know, they wanted to see that piece of history, you know, and what I was doing. You know, and the racers are just amazing, supportive, and along with the tech officials and the whole staff at the speed trials.
Oh, that's really cool.
That is excellent.
Because when I first started the motorcycle, I didn't have permission to race it. I just knew one day I would race it, and I really didn't think it would come together that quick. I had the motorcycle 75% built before I even had permission to race it. I'm just hard-headed. Once I set a goal, I'm just going to keep on going. My theory is we'll ask for, permission is a little bit better, or forgiveness is better than permission.
There you go.
I love that rule.
So, Dan, are you thinking about and would they entertain letting you run something bigger?
Yes, that's actually my next goal. All right, what I did was race the Bonneville Motorcycle Speed Trials. Well, the SCTA, the Southern California Timing Association, that's what hosts Speed Week, and that's, predominantly cars. And, they're jet-powered cars running over 600 miles an hour, piston-driven cars running 450. Well, I would like to become the world's fastest blind man, which there's a man in Europe that's been 200.4. He does it with assistance, which I'm not taking nothing away from him, but, I do mine completely independently. So if I could go over 200, I'll become the world's fastest blind man. Well, if I set a class record at the SALT and it's over 200, then I become a member of the real prestigious 200 miles an hour club. So that would be my ultimate goal. And I had the car laid out in my head. It would be what's called a Lakester, which is a four-wheel, open-wheel car that the wheels are wider than the chassis, and it'll be a turbocharged 1,000cc motorcycle engine. It's the I Blown Gas Lakester class. I is for the 1,000cc, B for blown, which could be turbocharged or supercharged, gas for gasoline, not alcohol or nitromethane, and Lakester for the four-wheel open. And right now the record is 194, so if I could bump it over 200, I become a member of the 200-mile-an-hour club at Salt and become the world's fastest blind man. That's my ultimate goal.
What's your timeline looking like?
If I had the sponsorship, I could be ready next year, 2017. But it's so expensive. Now I was blessed with my motorcycle. When I started my motorcycle, I had so many companies step up and sponsor parts or a little bit of money, and then had friends that helped. And, you know, it was overwhelming. The National Federation of Blind helped. It was just really overwhelming, you know. But racing is in very hand-in-hand with your budget. So, you know, if I had a budget sitting here, I could have it done. But if not, I'll just 15 feet out my back door is my shop. I'll just start working on it a little bit at a time.
Did you ever see the movie The World's Fastest Indian?
I love that movie. And if anybody likes to read books, there's a book about Burt Monroe. It's called One Good Run, The Legend of Burt Monroe.
So what was it like when you first got to the training center as a well-accomplished racer, all that stuff, but now you knew you needed the skills, and you kind of came in knowing Miss Wilson and Dr. Maurer, Rick Abono, and then you're going to meet JD. Was JD there?
Oh, yeah. He's still there. Yep.
So what was it like when you first walked in, like you're going to start training?
Well, I don't think of myself any different than anybody else because, you know, I race motorcycle, you know, that, and that's the way I've always been my whole life, racing wise, you know, humble. That's where I was brought up. That's where I am. And so I tell everybody, you know, we put our pants on one leg at a time. If I try to jump in both legs, I bust my nose on the ground when I fall. So I went, you know, with the attitude that, you know, I'm no different than anybody else. I'm here to train. I was there for a while before I even probably told some of the people. But I tell people, and I'm not afraid to say this, I cried my first night there because you're scared. You don't know what to expect. You know, you get dropped off and you have no idea what to expect. You know, and then you cry your last night there because you've came so far, and also you've made so many friends. And in that small community, you feel so quote-unquote normal. You know, Ruston's a small town, 30,000 people. So you walk just about everywhere you go, and everybody in every restaurant and every, you know, drugstore, grocery store, they're used to dealing with the blind. So you don't feel abnormal. You know, you feel totally independent there, you know, and, you know, you and your classmates go out and have fun and go to dinner. So it's overwhelming, you know, so it's good, man. It was one of the best things I've done.
Yeah. I know what you're talking about. You find yourself in a bubble.
Exactly.
And no difference here in Minneapolis. We have two training centers. So people, there's a lot more people, but there is a center core there that are used to seeing the blind out and about. So they're accustomed to it.
Yeah. Yeah. They're not going to come up, do you need help getting across the street, you know, or you know, take it. No. They just look at you and just keep on going like it's no big deal. And you know, hopefully one day society in general will get that way. But, of course, it takes skilled people on the other side of it. But it's like you said, it's your own little bubble where you feel so normal. It's awesome.
This is stop G on.
Now, you've met Christopher Venter.
Yes, the blind scooter guy.
That blind scooter guy. That's what he did an interview.
That's right.
I listened to it. It was real good. Actually, I was on the phone with Skype with Christopher this morning.
Yeah, I was just about to call you. Also, my Skype went off, and then I got a message. It's him. He was like 1 minute away from interrupting this conversation. He was just saying, hey, you're going to be talking to Dan Parker. Good luck. Blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
You were on the phone with him last week when I called you too.
Yeah, he's Christopher. He's a good guy. You know, we've it's amazing how far he's come in only 2 years. You know, technology wise, and you know, he's came a long ways. But you know, we talk, you know, about the frustrations, the you know, of blindness, you know, life in general, and just about everything. You know, and so it's good to network and meet people.
I'm going to back you up here a second. It was 2 years and a month or so, and you were racing on the Bonneville Salt Flats.
Yeah, but I don't even think about that. That's just, to me, that's just normal because all I've done my whole life is race.
Hey, it was less. It was only a little over a year, I think, when you went to Bonneville.
Yep.
It was 2 years when you went to LCB.
Yeah, it was a year and a half the first time I went salt.
Yeah.
Okay, Dan, what would you suggest to someone that's, you know, going blind or newly blind? What words of advice would you give them?
Two things of advice. Take it one day at a time. Don't let it overwhelm you. And to always know there is a life after blindness. And then the second piece of advice I tell people is to get an iPhone. An iPhone is absolutely life-changing for a blind person. And the amount of technology that's built in that phone from the factory is amazing, and they're life-changing for a blind person. You know, where there's a GPS app, a money reader app, being able to, you know, read text messages, Twitters, emails, everything. It's amazing.
Is there anything you want to add, Pete?
No, it's just been really great talking to you, Dan. You're an inspiration. I'm sure our listeners will want to hear more and see more. So give us some contact information and where they might hear and see more of the Dan Parker story.
All right. My Facebook page is Dan Parker Quest for the Salt. My Twitter handle is Quest for the Salt. And I appreciate it. And hopefully one day we'll be doing another interview after I ran 200 miles an hour at the Salt and become the world's fastest blind man. And so that's something I'm looking forward to the future. Try to use one of my quotes in life. You can make excuses or make it happen.
That's great. It's going to be hard to keep up with the world's fastest blind guy, though.
I got to get there first.
I heard another quote where you people said you were crazy. What do you want to do, die? And you said, this ain't about dying. This is about living.
Exactly. You know, so many of my family and friends absolutely hated that motorcycle. You know, I've been told it's a waste of time. It's a waste of money. And I, you know, now the opinion has changed, but you know, I've told them at the time, this is saving my life. This is giving me a purpose to get out of this house every day, to go out in that shop and work. And you know, this is therapy. And so if my life is valuable, that motorcycle is valuable because it gave me a purpose back in life.
And that's what you need.
It is. You know, it's one of the things that's so discouraging is the unemployment rate for the blind. And there's so many talented blind people have so many skills to offer, you know, school systems, to, you know, businesses, to their community. All they need is a chance, you know, somebody to get roll the dice a little bit, give them a chance, and they'll be shocked what they can, you know, find out what a blind person can do.
Well, congratulations on all your accomplishments. You're well driven.
You are driven blind, buddy.
Oh, thank you.
You can go to a good training center, but if you have a drive, if you have a goal, or you know, if you're self-motivated, all you need are the skills and the confidence to take it.
That's right. You know, and we've all seen people there. We had a couple of people drop out of the training center and they just weren't ready for it. But everybody that graduates, they're an absolutely changed person the day they leave than they were the day they started. It changes your life.
Well, thank you, Dan Parker, for coming on and sharing your story with our listeners on blind abilities. And it's really an honor to meet you and talk with you.
Thank you, guys. I really appreciate to be invited. I enjoy your podcast, your shows, and what you're doing, and sharing with other blind people, you know, that there's blind people out there doing things, and that, you know, if we all dig deep within ourselves, we can all do it ourselves, you know.
It's been a pleasure, Dan.
Thank you very much.
When we share
what we see through each other's eyes,
we can then begin to bridge the gap
between the limited expectations
and the realities
of blind abilities.
Of blind abilities.
For more podcasts with a blindness perspective, check us out on the web at www.blindabilities.com, on Twitter at blindabilities, download our app from the App Store, Blind Abilities, that's two words, or send us an email at info@blindabilities.com. Thanks for listening.